With culture, we have a very new system, certainly novel in primates, that has been rapidly changing. The transmission properties are not well defined, and our ability to pick up information has recently rapidly evolved. Why? Nearly 150 years ago, Charles Darwin suggested that the bigger a population, the faster its rate of evolutionary change. Paleoanthropologist John Hawkes has used mathematics to demonstrate that connection between population size and the speed of evolution. In the past 11,000 years, the human population has blossomed from about 5 million globally to 6.5 billion. What are the evolutionary ramifications for this rapidly growing human population of ours, and how have humans evolved in the relatively recent past? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the most recent developments in human evolution, and what were the factors that brought them about? What effect does culture have on human evolution? And where does drinking cow's milk fit into human evolution? Our guest, John Hawkes, is a professor of anthropology at the UW-Madison.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks.
Well, now, Charles Darwin died in 1882, and I'm curious, what do you think if he could see all the work being done in 2008, the Human Genome Project, and what's now known about DNA, what would Darwin think he had gotten right, and what would he be astonished to find had been shown to be different?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is Darwin really didn't know anything about the mechanism of heredity. I mean, not only did they not know about DNA, they didn't know about Mendelian inheritance. So they didn't have any conception of genes or how things were transmitted. Darwin assumed that this was all based on blending, that parents would mate with each other and their traits would sort of blend together in the offspring. And one of the real strengths of evolutionary theory that Darwin developed is that it doesn't matter what the mechanism of inheritance was. It still works regardless of what the basis of it should be. So I think the first thing that would surprise him is that we know. I mean, he was a great animal breeder, and he was interested in pigeons and dog breeding and cattle breeding. To say that today we can tell you exactly why whippets have the ability to race. You know, we know the gene that's responsible for making them really fast dogs. We know the genes that are responsible for making these pigeon variants in many cases. You know, to say that we know what this is, we've traced it through pedigrees, and all you had to do was keep careful records and pay attention to what things were connected together. I think he'd be really fascinated by that.
How does mutation play into it?
Well, with mutations, of course, when DNA sequences change and they change randomly, you know, anytime sperm are created or eggs are created in an animal, there's a possibility of a DNA sequence changing. Almost all of those changes are neutral. They don't do anything. And that's because only a small fraction of our genome is responsible for making stuff. Of the changes that do something, most of them are bad. They mess things up somehow. And only a very small fraction of things are potentially good. You know, they make you have more offspring. That's what we tend to mean by good. Just saying it that way, you can see that something that makes you have more offspring is not necessarily something that we value or is something that we, you know, give a high value to in society. But in evolutionary terms,
That's what it's all about.
I tell my students, my undergraduates, you know, you guys, Darwin would say you're withering on the vine.
You
know, because
you don't have any children
you
yet.
Don't have any kids yet. And you're able to. You could be doing it now. So the things we value are not always the things that are good in an evolutionary sense.
I guess it makes sense that mutation would be logically an undesirable thing if you assume that the organism that's reproducing is the product of this evolution, which has made it suitable for its environment already, and that therefore any variation from that would be unsuitable.
Yeah. And to simplify what is in mathematical terms sort of complicated, you imagine that we're a finely tuned device, like an Audi, you know, or something, right? And a mutation is some random change to this. You know, it's like you open the hood of your car and you take a big sledgehammer and you hit it. If your car is not working very well, there's some slight chance that this will help. But the overwhelming probability is this is going to be bad. And that's what mutations are like.
Can you give us some sense of the time scale that you're talking about with human evolution?
Well, with human evolution, primates originated shortly after the age of dinosaurs. And so all of today's monkeys, lemurs, and so on have diversified across the last 60 million years. Humans originated, diverged from apes as a lineage around 5 to 7 million years ago. So this is about a tenth of the time back to the dinosaurs. That's the time period that we call human evolution, because this is a time that humans are evolving on a lineage separate from today's primates. Now, in terms of what I study, I study this entire time period. The early part of this is Australopithecines, early hominids. The later part, within the last 2 million years, this is members of our own genus, Homo. And when we talk about recent evolution, and this is a word that when you say recent, you really have to define, because people think recent, they're thinking the last 100 years. When we say recent, we're thinking about things that happened in the last 10,000 years or so. So this is the span of recorded history. That's recent for us.
Well, we don't usually think of recorded history as including evolution, but you certainly are demonstrating mathematically that it does. What is it that makes us different when we get to, I guess, Australopithecus? What is the difference between that and one of the ape forebears?
Okay, so to give sort of a timeline of the way that human characteristics arose, because I think that's one way to look at it. We think of the differences between us and apes. We walk upright. We have big brains. We're not covered in fur. You know, big changes like that between us and other apes. Australopithecines, the early hominids, were essentially ape-like. They had ape-like body sizes. Apes are variable. But chimpanzees and early hominids, very similar in their size, very similar in the size of their brains, probably similar culturally. We imagine that early hominids had tool-using capacities that were like chimpanzees. The difference between them and chimps is they walked on two legs. They were obligate, upright walking. And that probably led to other consequences. By 2.5 million years ago, these guys are making tools that we can observe in the archaeological record, stone tools. They begin to hunt animals. The origin of our genus, Homo, 2 million years ago or so, seems to have been involved with increasing the proportion of meat in the diet, becoming more devoted to sort of a hunting, scavenging culture.
Do we know why the push to walk on two legs? In other words, just the way you have giraffes with tall necks and we assume it's so they can reach the leaves that are up high and that's mm-hmm. why they evolved with the long necks. Do we know about the switch to walking on two legs?
There are more stories about this than – okay, so Darwin's story was that humans started walking on two legs early, and this was to free the hands so that you could carry tools around and become a hunter. That's the traditional sort of man the hunter model. And you would only do this if you didn't have to climb in the trees anymore. So that was the idea for a savanna adaptation. You go from the forest to the savanna, you become a hunter, you're using your hands to make tools, to carry weapons, and that causes the shift to bipedality. What we know now is that that's absolutely false. Didn't happen that way because all of the early bipedal hominids live in the forest. And none of them made any stone tools that we can see. And we have no evidence that they were particularly carnivorous, that they were eating any animals. So now we tend to explain this in social terms. Maybe this is a change in the strategy in walking in terms of maintaining different social interactions. Maybe this is about display processes. In chimpanzees, one of the reasons to walk on two legs, aside from carrying things, is to make yourself look big. And to, you know, threat display.
Get up on your hind legs.
Exactly right. Maybe this is about having larger offspring, larger kids that you have to carry with one hand. In primates, kids are able to cling on while they're really small and then they climb on the mother's backs. But that becomes ineffective over a certain size. And maybe this is about carrying. But I have to say that's one of the most heavily discussed topics in anthropology now because there are lots of ideas about it and they're really hard to test.
What other adaptations early on other than this larger brain and the bipedal motion?
So with our genus, we see the larger brain size, and that increases continuously. It's sort of a gradual increase from 2 million years ago up to the Neanderthals, who lived within the last 100,000 years. The brain grows and grows and grows and grows. Alongside that, we see evidence for increased complexity in archaeology. People are making more complicated tool types over time. They're pursuing strategies in terms of finding raw materials that are more complicated. They can move seashells hundreds of miles, for instance. So we know that they were branching out. They were doing different things. After the Neanderthals, this is the interesting thing, because the Neanderthals is a big topic. You know, they are a population we know a lot about. We don't know necessarily what their connection to living people are. And they're very geographically focused. They're European as opposed to other parts of the world where we don't have as many fossils. Since that time, our brains have shrunk.
I've suspected that about my own.
Our brains are shrinking. They've shrunk in the last 20,000 years. This is the recent aspect of what we're studying. In the last 20,000 years, the brain has shrunk by 200 cubic centimeters. If it went 200 more, we would be Homo erectus sized again. You know, so this has been a radical
so
decline.
It's not necessarily an insult to call somebody a Neanderthal because they actually had the biggest brain in history.
It's true. And so you wonder, you know, what causes this change? Why is there, you know, this apparent reversal in brain size?
Well, is the size, though, necessarily linked to intelligence? In other words, just because it's bigger, is it better?
Well, my speculation, and I'll say it's speculation because it is that, there's two things that are important about the brain. One is that it does things that you like. Like it makes you figure out how to mate and figure out how to find food. The other thing is it does things you don't like. And the biggest thing, you know, everybody today is familiar with energy conservation. Having a brain on top of your head that's 1,500 cubic centimeters, this is like burning a 5-watt light bulb all the time. Now, 5 watts seems very energy efficient, right? That's like, you know, the compact fluorescent. But in evolutionary terms, you have to eat a lot of food to keep this 5 watts going. Your whole body only puts out 20 watts. So that's a big expenditure. And in terms of conserving energy, you want to have a small brain. Now, that creates sort of a vice grip in evolutionary terms because you want it to be bigger because you want to be smarter. And you want it to be smaller because you want it to be more energy efficient. And so that means that the things that are advantageous are not things that make the brain grow or necessarily things that make it shrink, but things that create an optimum combination of size and function. And those mutations are the ones that are the hardest to get. So I'm imagining that probably what we're seeing in the last 20,000 years is mutations that are very rare that would never have happened before just because of, you know, they're threading an almost impossible needle. They make the brain work well while making it smaller. It's a hard thing to do, but probably those mutations are the ones that have been selected, the ones that have been changing.
Well, I suppose in a colder climate like Europe, it would be your advantage to have a smaller brain that would not lose as much heat, I suppose. I have to wonder also just in terms of the physics of it, a center of gravity, that kind of thing, if it's not a liability to have this big head on your shoulders when you're trying to chase after a mammoth or something.
I love this, the illustration of this sort of Star Trek image of what humans are going to be like with the giant head, right? You know, it clearly could never happen that way, you know, because that direction of evolution, you know, isn't going to work. You know, you can't have this giant bobblehead person, you know, but also because it doesn't look at what the constraints really are. You know, there's a developmental constraint in brain size. If you can develop your brain faster, if you can develop it in 12 years instead of 15, then you have that leg up in terms of when you're able to reproduce. If you can do that faster, then your generation time is shorter, which is a direct advantage to you in terms of reproduction. So the brain is such a complicated system. It's hard to envision really what the optimum is.
You have to wonder about reproduction too. I mean, as the brain got bigger, wasn't childbirth much more cumbersome? And doesn't that play against survival?
Oh, we faced a terrible constraint. And this constraint started with the origin of our genus. 2 million years ago, babies' heads, infant head size at birth, is at the modern level. Every increase in brain size that we saw after that time, and you have to those early humans had brain sizes when they were adults of about 600 to 800 cubic centimeters. Today's brain sizes average 1,350. Neanderthals averaged 1,450 cubic centimeters. So all of that brain growth happened by changing the pattern of development after birth. And this is fundamentally a change in humans compared to other primates. Other primates, their brains grow before birth at a very high rate, and after they're born, it's a slow rate. And you can see why that is, because energy transmission from breast milk into the baby is much less efficient than energy transmission from the placenta into the baby. So you want to have that brain growth early. Humans have changed this system. And that system change is one that must have required cultural change, you know, because we have to supplement our baby's diets with other stuff in order to keep this energy going. But the constraint was there because of the pelvis. Babies' heads have to go through the pelvis, and the pelvis cannot get any bigger in humans and still be able to walk right. So again, it comes back to bipedalism and the constraints that it put on us.
And okay, if you took a Neanderthal person mm-hmm. and somebody today, what would be the most profound changes other than that our brain size is slightly less, if I follow you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are the other changes that would be instantly apparent?
Well, the one that people would notice the most is robusticity. When you look at a Neanderthal skull, what you'll observe is that they have a brow ridge that goes right across the front above their eyes. They have a very slight chin, but their face projects forwards a lot. Their nose projects forwards. Their skull is long and highly muscled. And when we look at their long bones are thick and curved across their entire length. And that means that the muscles that were on them were very large. These guys were heavily muscled compared to living humans. They were a little shorter on average than living people. But of course, living people are highly variable. You know, they weren't shorter than pygmies, for instance. And in fact, if you consider the variation that you see among people today, that's another aspect that's new. You know, the fact that we have very small-bodied populations in some places and dark skin in some places, light skin in others, this is probably relatively new. So when we're looking at changes that have happened recently, we've become wimpier looking. You know, we don't look like we're as powerful and strong. Our technology is very sophisticated. We don't know what the technology of Neanderthals would have been like if their culture – we don't know what their potential was. I'll put it that way. Their technology was simple compared to ours. We don't know if we could take a Neanderthal out of the Pleistocene and plug them into today's society, what they would be like. We've gotten some genetic indications of this recently because we've done gene sequences of Neanderthals, and we can find that there's a gene related to language in living people. It's related to language because when you have a mutation to this gene, it messes up language. So we know it's related somehow. The gene's name is FOXP2. It's one of these arbitrary – fox is short for forkhead box. It's, it does nothing to do with foxes. But this gene has mutations that humans have that we share with bats. Because bats and birds, songbirds, because those changes change the structure of the brain in ways that allow greater language perception, greater sound perception apparently in bats and birds. Songbirds have this brain activated in the parts of their – this gene activated in the parts of their brain that create the songs. So this is a really interesting gene. Humans have a form of this that's found in no other primate. Neanderthals share that with humans, and that's interesting because we thought that this was really a new thing that maybe was characteristic of human language. If it is, then it's something that Neanderthals also had. So language is old.
All the way back to the split from Neanderthal versus
at least that far. At least that far. Or we got it or they got it through interbreeding with each other. So that's a real interesting data point now about Neanderthals and their capacities.
So they could have been in musicals.
They might have been.
I think some have been. So what happened to them then? Do we have any better idea now than we had 50 or 100 years ago?
Well, we know now – we've added a lot of precision. The basic disagreement is, are the Neanderthals dead and gone, extinct, and they didn't contribute any of their genes to later people? Or did they stick around? Are we part
in?
Neanderthal now? And we have some increased resolution on this. We have a couple of genes in humans that look like they might have come from Neanderthals. So, you know, I say look like. We haven't found the forms of these genes in a Neanderthal yet. That's the test that remains to happen. But we can tell that these genes came into humans probably from somewhere else, and they expanded rapidly after 30,000 years ago, which is the time that humans and Neanderthals came into contact. So I say the smoke is there, but the gunshot is not yet. You know, and found the weapon.
For intermarriage.
Exactly, for intermarriage. The Neanderthals declined, and we don't find any more of them after 30,000 years ago. Their lifestyle became obsolete, I'll put it that way. We know that the way that they made their living and the anatomy that they had to support that didn't work anymore. That's why they're gone. But the question, and this is one that I've researched quite a bit, the question is, did they have anything that was worthwhile? We know that long sort of evolutionary distances in mammals are crossed by interbreeding. We have, you know, species that have been separated for millions of years that you can interbreed and have fertile offspring. You know, everybody knows about horses and donkeys. They have mules. Those aren't fertile. But lions and tigers have ligers, and they're fertile. And, you know, so there are lots of examples of this in primates and other mammals. Neanderthals and humans are so close to each other, they would have been able to interbreed. But the question is, did Neanderthals have things that were worthwhile that came into humans and increased? We can tell that there weren't very many interbreedings, because if there were, our present-day diversity would be much higher than it is. But given that there was a small fraction possible, you know, are there things that they had that retained some advantage that would have spread and diversified? That's the point where today's Human Genome Project and its successors are making us able to look for rare things that might have come from there.
How many – just out of curiosity, how many Neanderthal specimens do we have to work with?
There are hundreds. There are hundreds. Most of these are fragmentary. You know, when we talk about Neanderthals, you imagine, okay, there's this skeleton that somebody found and it's laid on the ground. We have a dozen that are like that. There are skeletons that were laid on the ground. And then we have lots of specimens, hundreds of specimens that are, you know, part of the lower jaw and some teeth. We can do a lot with those fragments. One of the reasons why I like to study Neanderthals is you actually have enough of them to do some stuff. Earlier hominids, people from other places that are equivalently old, we have one or three, you know, and it's hard to do anything. With Neanderthals, you can do some stuff. But in terms of sampling their genes, it turns out that the preservation of specimens is really variable between different sites. You know, some of these were constantly cold and seemed to have preserved their DNA very well. Some of them were not. The specimen out of which we have the best DNA preservation is a specimen that wasn't recognized as being a human to start with. And they threw it in a box with the fauna, you know, the deer bones. And for that reason, nobody touched it after that. You know, so one of the main reasons why we have problems sequencing things is because they get contaminated. You know, these archaeologists are
messing with them.
Know, touching them and dealing with them, and they get their DNA in them. And it's amazing the extent to which this contamination spreads. So this specimen has a really high preservation. It's from a cave called Vindija, which is my favorite place because it's a beautiful cave.
And where is that?
Vindija is in Croatia. It's right on the Slovenian border. And this bone has, you know, 99% lack of contamination. It's really good. But it's an exceptional case. And every case where something's very well preserved like this seems to be exceptional. You know, for some reason, it's just a freak. This has really good preservation.
More on evolution now when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, John Hawkes, and we're looking at evolution, particularly in the more recent human history, going back maybe as far as 40,000 years, 10 to 40,000 years. Where do people actually start experiencing disease? Did the Neanderthals live long enough even to have that kind of problem?
You know, you imagine Neanderthal societies. They were small groups. They were very mobile. They moved around a lot. But they never were in contact with crowds of people. You know, they would meet their neighboring group and there would be a group of 30 or 50 of them, and that was it. In that context, today's diseases, the real major diseases of human history, like smallpox and the plague, they can't make it in that. They can't transmit themselves across a population that's so sparsely populated. And so Neanderthals had tremendous problems with chronic diseases like osteoarthritis. You know, we see evidence for that in their bones. Much of that comes from their stressful lifestyle. They almost certainly had some of the sort of common cold type diseases that we do now, because those are diseases that spread easily by very sparse contacts between people. We think they probably had tuberculosis. Tuberculosis easily spread in the air, and it's a long-lasting disease. So it can stay in a population, in a reservoir, with people sort of carrying it for a long time. But most of the big diseases of history came in when people started living in cities. When they start living in one place, doing agricultural subsistence so that, you know, they're going out to the same fields, they're in contact with the same people, they're peeing in each other's water supply, you know, that creates the context in which the major diseases like smallpox and cholera and typhoid can proliferate and spread. That's the context that creates malaria in humans. Before 30,000 years ago, there's no malaria in humans at all. 30,000 years ago, vivax malaria comes in. It's the less severe of the malaria parasites now. Falciparum malaria comes in 5,000 years ago, and this seems to be a response to people living in places, keeping pottery, making little ponds, and that creates the habitat for the mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes allow basically the chimpanzee form of malaria to jump into humans and create the falciparum, which is the most dread disease killer that's still with us today. So all of these diseases are a big recent change in human environments.
I can see then already how an increased population is going to speed up evolution, because if you're going to survive these diseases, you have to develop some kind of an immune system or trigger, say, to malaria. And of course, if you do that, you're the one whose offspring will survive. So there has to be, in other words, there's some kind of evolutionary response to the disease that comes from this coming together, the culture.
That's right. You know, diseases are immediately – they have high impact on human mortality. And when we look at Neolithic skeletons in cemeteries, you know, in this time period, people are burying each other in cemeteries. So if we excavate them now, we get a cross-section of society. The first signature of population growth in these societies is that you start to see a lot of dead kids. And you wouldn't think, well, you know, if they're dying young, how does that make their population grow? You know, how's it connected? The connection is disease. These kids die young because the population is large. You can't sustain a large population with lots of dead kids without a very high growth rate. And so the dead kids aren't creating the population growth. They're like the side effect of it. You know, this is showing how disease comes in the growing population. And every one of those kids who's died of some disease is selection. You know, the kids who survived it are the ones who had descendants today. So that's where selection is happening.
I see the survival of the fittest in terms of surviving disease, but – and maybe this is only thinking in terms of more recent human history, but you've also got all these wars and conquests and hoarding of resources and manipulating things in a way that has nothing to do with biology but ends up, I would assume, having an effect.
Well, you create – when you have a larger society, you create new opportunities for how to make a lifestyle. When you have – a new agricultural lifestyle, you know, it creates new dietary selection. But also, you know, think of people who are successful as farmers versus people who aren't successful. To the extent to which that translates to having more kids survive, then things like work ability come into it. Things like, you know, being able to manipulate your neighbors so that you have that resource that they are willing to share with you because you manipulated them so well becomes, you know, a possible target. Having hierarchical structures where some people are having, you know, lots and lots of kids because they have a harem of women and other people aren't, you know, that creates new opportunities. We don't have adaptations, genes that relate to all these opportunities. You know, many of them are cultural opportunities that don't last that long. But each of them creates its opportunities. And some of those are things that we probably have new mutations that are trying to fit in.
It would be interesting to know, for example, how something like literacy would affect the development of human eyesight.
Well, this is one of the interesting ones. Myopia, you know, nearsightedness, this seems to be fairly new. And it's not just new, meaning that, you know, sure, 300 years ago, there weren't very many people who wore eyeglasses. But the susceptibility to myopia, which isn't, you know, you inherit a gene, you definitely will become nearsighted, but there's a susceptibility factor. You can inherit a gene and be, you know, more likely in the right context to become nearsighted. This seems to be a new thing. So what does that mean? Well, it's hard to say, you know, because with every one of these genes, there's the potential that it does something else that you're not paying attention to. So here's a good example. The Duffy blood type. Most people know about blood types. There's ABO and there's plus or minus. The ABO is the ABO blood type. The plus or minus is the rhesus blood type. There's another blood type. There's 20 of them. But there's one called the Duffy blood type. And like ABO, it has three forms. Two of the forms, like A and B, make different antigens that are on blood cells. One of them, like O, makes nothing. O is the universal donor because it doesn't have these antigens on it. The Duffy blood type doesn't interfere with transfusions, so you don't get tested for it. But it's there, and some people don't make this antigen at all. They noticed it when they were doing blood typing on combat soldiers in the Korean War. You know, this is where this comes out because they're trying to figure out what things lead to, you know, potential problems after surgeries. So they discover this blood type. Sub-Saharan Africans have about 95% this O Duffy blood type, the one that doesn't make the antigen. And in some contexts, that creates complications for surgeries and that sort of thing. It's very rare to have that kind of complication, but it can happen. The import of this, Duffy O is a new gene. It, as a mutation, originated 27,000 years ago, give or take. That's our date estimate. Duffy O makes you almost completely immune to vivax malaria. So here's this blood type. We found it for completely unrelated reasons to what it is there for. We now know that the distribution of people who have this Duffy blood type, they don't get vivax malaria. There's no vivax malaria in the places where Duffy is very common. It's because it's such a good resistance that the parasite can't spread.
It went away.
It went away in those places. And that's the tremendous effect of this, you know, evolutionary change. It took 6,000 or 8,000 years of people dying of vivax malaria to get this up to where it was common and helping. You know? So I can't say it's a good thing. You know, it's the response. But the reason why we find things and notice them is in many cases has nothing to do with why they're there. And it takes some, you know, investigation, some detective work to try to figure out what the other effects of genes are.
And I suppose that would be a big impediment if you were tempted to say immediately, well, why don't we just work with this Duffy and make everybody, you know, immune to malaria? But then there's another aspect to it that we might not be immediately aware of, a downside.
That's true. The malaria parasite is the hardest one to try to fight because it's so tricky. You know, it's a complicated parasite. It's not a bacterium. It's a microbe that is a eukaryote, and it can shift and change. And it goes through cycles in your liver and in your brain and your blood cells and in the mosquito. It's really hard to fight. But when we have things like that, of course, with HIV, the same question comes up. There's a gene in Europeans called CCR5 delta 32. It is carried by about 10% of people from Europe. This gene makes you very resistant to HIV. And that's really important in HIV research. They're trying to figure out how can we use the information that we get from this gene to figure out the pathway that we can interrupt that this virus infects cells, you know, because if we could do the same thing as this gene, we'd have an opportunity to make, you know, a big difference in infection rates.
Can you say something about the Human Genome Project itself? You know, you've been mentioning certain genes that we know. What, at this point, do we have mapped, and what sorts of projects besides the human genome are out there?
Okay. The Human Genome Project was the, you know, they assembled the DNA of one person is what they said. The real project took the DNA of about 30 different people and put together different parts in different places. So it's sort of a mosaic of different people. Then there was the Venter project that was Craig Venter's DNA. So there you have one person. All right. So when you have a sequence like that, it's 3 billion nucleotides long. You know, if you put those together, I don't know how long it would be, but if you put them together as nucleotides, it's a meter long. So it's a lot of information. It's hard to go through. We have computers that look in that sequence and find the parts of it that do stuff. And you can recognize these parts that do stuff based on their sequence. You know, we know that certain kinds of sequences make proteins, and certain kinds of sequences make RNA that ends up being functional in terms of the cell. So we look for things. Some of those things end up being things that we knew about already. You map a gene and you say, well, if you predict the protein that this gene would make, it looks very much like this other protein that we already know about. And so you say, hey, that's the gene for this protein. In other cases, you get a gene and the computer tells you this is a gene. And you say, well, we've never identified that protein. We don't know what it is. A part of it looks like this protein that we found in a fruit fly that we think, you know, connects to the cell membrane in some way. And so you say, okay, this gene, let's give it a number. FOXP2, and we'll say it looks like this other gene in a mouse, or it looks like it's got a function that embeds in cell membranes. And that's what we know. So that is sort of the initial mapping of the human genome. Here are the genes. We predict how many they are. We know now that there's 20,500, give or take. That's, you know, because we counted them. But out of those, you know, maybe 3,000 or 4,000, we know pretty well what they do, and the rest of them, we don't.
Okay, so if you had a map of your own genes, you know, you had the, what did you say, how many thousand?
20,500.
Okay, there are the 20,500 genes that go with John Hawks, and there they are. It's a whole big computer printout.
It can be.
I mean, I'm trying to physically picture what it is you have.
Yeah.
And then how you would link it to your own physical self, your characteristics. Is there anything that you can do to go from these results that are there to kind of understanding you in particular?
Right. So there, you know, the question is, what makes you you? You know, what makes you different from somebody else genetically? What makes you different from a chimp genetically? For the chimp question, of course, you just line up. Here's the chimp genome. Here's the human genome. And there are obvious differences between them. Chimps have 48 chromosomes. We have 46. And we know, hey, chromosome 2 in humans is made up of two different chromosomes in chimpanzees. And they fuse together. And we know where it happened and we can outline that. But then the question, how are you different from other people? That requires us to look not at our differences in the whole genome from another species, but our differences in the whole genome from each other. And the first project that attempted to do this is called the HapMap. HAP is short for haplotype. And a haplotype is nothing more than a sequence. There's a sequence of DNA that makes up your chromosome. And if you consider any particular stretch of that, you might share that stretch of sequence with somebody else, or you might be different at some number of places from somebody else. Well, the HapMap was an attempt to find the variations in humans. It found 3 million of them. And to map these variations in terms of where in the genome they are and how many people have them. So they studied people from Northern Europe. It turns out that these people of Northern European ancestry are all – they live in Utah. You know, so this is the Utah CEF project. People from West Africa, people from China and from Japan. And they sampled 120 people from Utah, 120 people from Africa, 180 people from Asia. And they figured out which people have which gene variants. How many copies of them are there? How are they linked to each other? And the linkage is really very clever. They sampled people, and in trios, one child and two parents, so that they could tell which sequences the child had inherited from the mother and which from the father. By doing that, you work out which of them are connected to each other, which of them are inherited together, and that creates a way of looking at linkage. The entire purpose of this really was medical. You want to know why some people are susceptible to diabetes, some people cardiovascular disease, what genes are involved in cancer. In order to figure these things out, you have to have a way of mapping which gene is associated with cancer. And to do that, you have to look at people who have cancer and people who don't have cancer and score them for all these genes. So the greater resolution you can get on this, the more able you are to focus down on the spot that really has an effect on cancer, for instance.
Well, let's see if we can get a sense of what some of these more recent evolutionary changes in humans are, and maybe even some notion of what we might expect around the corner when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Like Hamlet contemplating the skull of poor Yorick, John Hawke sees a lot more than most of us when he peers at a skull, something he does frequently. In fact, it's his job. That's the lead for the Wisconsin State Journal story recently about the work of our guest, John Hawke. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about evolution now. Okay, so now I've got this image of you looking at skulls. But what is it that brought you all this sort of media attention? What is the new work, the new discoveries that you found?
Well, we did a survey of the human genome looking for evidence of selection. And we were able to find genes that looked like that they had had new mutations that had increased really rapidly in the recent past, within the last 40,000 years. Most of them, you know, the majority of them, seem to have originated within the last 10,000 years. You know, and this seems surprising. If you're looking at thousands of things that have changed recently, well, we know how different we are from chimpanzees. And if you imagine that there are thousands of things in the last 10,000 years, extrapolate over the course of the last 6 million years, and you should expect that there would be millions of things. But there aren't. There's only thousands of things. So it looked like there were a tremendous number of genetic differences originating recently, and that this was unreasonably many compared to how many differences there are between us and chimps. Nobody expected that. Nobody really had thought about it very much. And the reason why we got some attention is because we had an explanation for it. And it's sort of a simple explanation. It's that there's more people. So more people means more potential mutations. It creates more opportunities for a response to selection. And of course, within the last 40,000 years, we have lots of cultural changes, environmental changes, and changes in fundamental lifestyle that have allowed those changes in the genes to be selected. So we had a theory that would explain this, and the theory itself is really simple. You know, it's just algebra, and somebody should have thought of it sooner. You know, I had to do a little bit of complicated stuff to relate it to our genetic evidence, but it was not a complicated thing to think of. The surprising aspect of this was we were able to say, look, the genes are there. We can see them changing, and it relates very well to the skeletal changes that we know were happening. But more important, it means that against all these stereotypes that humans have become more fit to their environment, that they haven't been changing very much, we can say, we predict that they're actually changing hundreds of times faster than they ever used to. And that's really, you know, surprising. It says something about where we've come from very recently.
And what kind of changes have we seen most recently then?
The biggest categories of changes are in genes related to disease. We have new diseases, and we're resisting them in almost every way we can think of. There are probably 50 genes in different populations that are defenses to malaria in one way or another. So that's a big category. The second is diet. We have new foods. We're eating domesticated grains. That is not a very good diet compared to what we used to have. You know, as hunter-gatherers, we ate a range of vegetable foods. We ate lean meat, and we did not eat processed starches and sugars, right? Now, today, you know, this is, you know, everybody says, well, you don't want the trans fats and you don't want meat. But of course, the reason why you don't want meat is because it's all corn-fed, fatty, domesticated meat instead of lean animal meat. And you don't want these starches and sugars and so on. Those new elements, today you say we're not well adapted to them yet. You know, we have health effects that come from eating too many of these. These lead to diabetes. They lead to cancers, especially cancers of the digestive tract, colon cancer. You know, they have bad effects on us. The bad effects on ordinary people of European descent or African descent are very minor compared to the bad health effects on people of Native American descent or Polynesian descent. They have a much higher rate of obesity from adopting a westernized diet and a much higher rate of type 2 diabetes. The reason for this is genetic. They have genes that are well adapted to a more broad-based hunter-gatherer diet. Europeans, Africans, and East Asians have the advantage of having lived in an agricultural population so that their ancestors died of not being able to digest these things as well. But today, some genes in these populations handle this agricultural diet better. So that's a big category of changes, these diet changes.
I'm intrigued by, speaking of diet, by the phenomenon of lactose intolerance. Mm-hmm. Is that actually the standard that people are now evolving away from? And in other words, are people naturally lactose intolerant, if we're talking about cow's milk in particular, mm-hmm. but developing a tolerance for it?
Yeah, I'm in the wrong state to comment on this.
Messenger of doom.
It used to be – I mean, it's really abnormal for mammals to be able to digest milk as adults. You imagine, you know, all mammals drink milk as babies, but there's no source for milk for an adult mammal. You know, you imagine the bull nosing up under the cow for milk. It doesn't happen. You know, so it's normal for mammals to lose the activity of this gene. Humans in a few populations, and in particular Northern Europeans, two populations in sub-Saharan Africa, one in East Africa and one in sort of Northwest Africa, and in Saudi Arabia, those populations have a higher incidence of tolerance of lactose. And that's entirely new. It's a mutation to the regulatory structure of the lactase gene, the enzyme that breaks down lactose. This mutation makes people able to drink milk as adults without having digestive complications. And when we say lactose intolerant, what we mean is they can drink milk, but it creates discomfort lots of times, you know, because their digestion isn't well tuned to it. It's entirely new, this lactase production in adults. And it's a consequence of domestication of cattle, sheep, and goats within the last 10,000 years. It's a new gene that originated 8,000 years ago. And in fact, there are five different forms of it. Three of them in sub-Saharan Africa, one in Saudi Arabia, and one in Northern Europe. It's been selected in parallel in all of these milk-drinking populations.
Yeah,
so we know the response is there because of the dietary change. We know that people were dying from not being able to digest milk. Or probably more to the point, women were not able to have as many kids who didn't have access to this rich dietary food resource. You know, think of how genes impact your reproduction. The simplest way is pregnancy. So if you're able to eat a little bit more during pregnancy, able to take in milk, that creates, you know, a little bit less infant mortality, and that impacts your fitness in the long term. So yeah, it's entirely new.
It's hard for me not to keep thinking sort of ethically in terms of genocide, nuclear war, environmental hazards, all that stuff. But if I just put all that aside and ask you to think mathematically, just looking at all the data you have and try to extend it into the future, not thinking in terms of changes we might make on a moral basis, but mm-hmm. just looking at the current human population now, genetic situation, where do you see things going if all else remains the same?
Well, okay. So the first thing, you know, you raise the issue of what do we do to ourselves? And of course, mm-hmm. this is what's going to happen. We're going to have genetic engineering. We're going to have kids that are whatever kind of kids we want. You know, oh yeah, the end trend is to have green-skinned kids, and we're going to have them. You know, it's going to be completely random and completely controlled by our culture. And so that means it's going to be fast. But in terms of, you know, if we extrapolate, based on past results, what's going to happen in the future, knowing what we know now. The first thing we can say is that the variation in mortality now is very, very low. You know, assuming that the trend continues to, reduce epidemic disease, there's still parts of the world that have lots of epidemic disease. If we make some successes against that, if we make other populations more like, say, America in terms of infant survivorship, then mortality variation is very low. People are not dying before they have kids. That means that the targets for change in terms of survivorship have reduced almost to nothing. We're not selecting for mortality anymore. But the variation in fertility, how many kids you have, this has not declined. You know, we still have people who are having large families. We still have people who don't have any kids at all. And that's going to continue because this is an element not of, health systems but of individual choice. So the targets for change are targets that are squarely painted on aspects of fertility. When I think of fertility variation, of course, there are things go into this like what age do you choose to reproduce? Because if you reproduce earlier, that tends to be selected, tends to be good because it means that your kids can have kids sooner. And that means that you have more descendants at any given time. In terms of culture now, we can see that people are choosing to have kids later in their lives. And in some instances, that creates fertility problems. So anything that allows late life fertility, we might expect to be a target of selection. Obesity is a big problem today, and it's going to increase in the future. Obesity induces infertility in some people. And so, again, that becomes a target of selection not because people are dying of heart disease, because they do that at age 53, but because they're not having as many kids as they would have otherwise because their fertility has been impacted. So thinking of, how things are going to change in the future, you have to look at the culture today and say, okay, it's going to change in the future. We can make predictions and they're going to be different because of technology, but based on what we've created to this point, selection is not going away in the future. It's just shifting its focus. It's shifting from mortality selection to fertility selection. And that means that different aspects of our behavior ultimately become drawn into the biology of the human population.
Wow, a lot of variables there. So in a way, it's going to be very hard to predict what the push-pull will be of all those factors. We have gotten a fascinating glimpse, at least, of what things might be and what they have been in the last 10 to 40,000 years. And, well, we'll have to have you back in, John, because I don't think we got everything there was even this time around to, as far as the data available, but certainly intriguing stuff.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.